This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
Do you think of YouTube as social media or as TV? And does YouTube worry you as much as other social media platforms? Do you have the same kind of rules in your house for YouTube as you do, say, TikTok or Snapchat or Instagram? 4 in 10 children reported being exposed to harmful content on YouTube, and the eSafety Commissioner is calling for YouTube to be included in the social media ban. So do you think that's the right way to go, or would that essentially be banning your kid from watching TV? We know on YouTube there are entire channels on everything from baking to golf, tutorials on makeup to watching an entire film. YouTube stars are just like movie and TV stars. They've got tens of millions of followers and are worth more than the average actor. So is YouTube just the new TV? How different is it from when we watched TV? If you stayed up late, you saw those adult ads, you know, you saw the ads that maybe you shouldn't be seeing. So is YouTube social media, or is it just telly? And would you like YouTube to be included in the social media ban? So if you have YouTube in your house, if you let your kids watch YouTube, do you view it as social media, or do you view it like TV? And do you think it should be a part of the social media ban? The eSafety Commissioner is calling for it to be included. Already so many texts on this. I'm 53. I watch far more YouTube than I do free-to-air TV. I let the kids have access. It's the greatest learning and entertainment tool ever created. But another from Sonia saying YouTube is just like television is dangerously ignorant. Television has an editorial process that includes human beings and regulation. YouTube has no algorithm. People that are allowed to watch it don't know how it works. We know that it amplifies extremist and harmful content. Liesel's in Woodend. Morning.
Hello.
Good morning. Is YouTube telly or is it social media? How do you feel about it?
I feel it's my absolute saviour when it came to my daughter, because she's extremely crafty. And she was desperate to learn how to crochet. And if it hadn't been for YouTube instructional videos, she would never have learned how to crochet. And also, too, on that crafty side of things, they've got fantastic instructional videos on how to do fantastic origami, complicated origami, and also instructional videos for art.
How do you then monitor the algorithm and what comes up? My daughter's very similar to you, Liesel. She loves all of those baking shows, and she follows these American young women who bake and taste food and all sorts of things. But you do have to watch some of the ads that scroll down the bottom. And that was the concern from the eSafety Commissioner, was the advertising. I remember watching something like a fake tan ad coming in, and, you know, it was just all questionable stuff. And at the time she was 10 years old. So do you have to sort of look at how the algorithm, what it feeds your daughter?
Well, yes. However, I've also briefed her and trust her, but I've briefed her to say if all those ads, don't click on them, ignore them. And that's what she does. That's essentially what she does. And we've been safe. So, yeah, it's a tricky area because, honestly, they do have some really good instructional content on areas like craft.
And so do you think it should be a part of the social media ban?
Me, personally, no.
Okay. Good to hear from you, Liesel. Thank you. Dr. Stephen Conway is the Course Director for Games and Interactivity at Swinburne. Stephen, I can't keep up with the texts, and people are really divided. One saying, absolutely, you know, this is just a gateway screen for kids and for harmful content and for addiction. And others saying YouTube is, for our family, is like the Encyclopedia Britannica. It's all about how you use it. Do you view YouTube as social media or as telly?
Hi, Rochelle. That's a good question. I don't think I actually view it as either. I think we need to understand how YouTube and various other technologies are their own thing, and the analogy doesn't quite hold to its TV or social media. So, you know, if we think of it in terms of social media, it has those short form video feeds, it has the ability to upload content, it has limited friend-based interaction, it has live interactive content, it has monetization, but it's not quite the same as TikTok or Facebook or Instagram. It has streaming, it has video, but it's not quite the same as television. I think of, you know, I agree with both sides of what you're receiving here. I think that I'm always reminded of The Sorcerer's Apprentice, the Goethe poem that was made famous by the Mickey Mouse cartoon, where he wants to skip the steps of cleaning the laboratory, so he tries to enchant the broom, and it all gets out of hand, and that, you know, it goes wild. I think we unleash these things without really understanding. We have this overconfidence. We're a bit lazy, as we all are. We want to get results. We don't really care about the cost. And then only in retrospect do we realize we're not in control, and that things are happening that we're not aware of, and that it cascades and it gets dangerous before we actually
then
understand
we do something.
Why we did it.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Hey, Stephen, stay with us. Let's have a chat to Maggie, who's in Mernda. Hi, Maggie.
Oh, hi. I'm just calling to say that this is an issue of moderation. It is quite easy to create a platform that the government could decide which videos are suitable for children to watch or not watch. In schools, we use ClickView, so teachers can load which videos from YouTube are appropriate and suitable for children to watch. So the eSafety Commissioner should be able to look at solutions so that content that is appropriate, maybe give them a rating, could be
through
another platform, through another app.
And I also wonder, Dr. Stephen Conway, you know, to Maggie's point there, when we look at YouTube and all of the different ways that people use it, both kids, teens and adults, our televisions now are designed to have YouTube on them as just another streaming platform, really. Does that then, in essence, make it easier to moderate or to control some of the elements that may be concerning depending on your age? So whether it be the live interaction or the comments or age appropriate, or like Maggie said, putting a rating, or, you know, like we used to have P, PG, M, R, you name it, treat it like television in that sense?
I think those tools are not really applicable in this situation, because simply the exponential amount of content makes it impossible for human moderation. So in that system you're referring to, you had a committee of people looking at each piece of content, assigning it a rating before it was released. Here, it's actually the reverse. The piece of content is released, and when it's flagged as controversial or so on, then a human looks at it. So if you want to create an algorithm, and, you know, as we've talked about, algorithms don't have morality. The machine doesn't have morality. So, and it doesn't understand context. It doesn't understand creativity. So, you know, the use of, and I'll just keep this very light, but the use of even getting around content moderation by using emotes and calling yourself, so there are YouTube video shorts where folks refer to themselves as corn stars, and they get into very graphic content around being all kinds of
They've beaten the algorithm, or are beating
the algorithm by using the word corn
instead,
which we all know. So even that is an easy way for them to get around this kind of legislation. So I think, like any policymaker, you have to look at it from the worst possible perspective. This is why we have speed limits that are so stringent, because it just takes one person to ruin it. So if I can be a bit controversial,
please.
I would say, if we want to look at it in the worst possible light, in all social media, We've drank the Kool-Aid thinking it's social. It's not. It's vampire media. It feeds on you. the more you use it, the more power it has over you. And you don't understand what it's doing, because like a parasite that's kind of draining your blood, and you're getting this sense of empowerment, this sense of amplification, you don't understand that it's actually using you for its own ends. But we're so ego-driven, we think we're in control.
How do you then manage, if the ban comes in and if it's successful, which is debatable, right? Because kids have got workarounds for absolutely everything. But there is a big theory in many of our lives as parents, as teachers, as carers, that you need, if you ban something, how does that actually help the child deal with the issue when they're going to be faced with it regardless at some point in their life? So how do you teach resilience? How do you teach moderation? How do you educate on what is right, what is not wrong, when you're being fed a lie, when you're being sold to, when you're being sucked in? Because at some point that's going to happen.
Absolutely right, Rochelle. I don't think a ban for this kind of phenomenon is ever the answer, just like a parent just banning something from the house, you know, like video games or whatever else. And again, I'll have to go back to the sorcerer's apprentice. What is needed by the apprentice is humility, is literacy, is critical thinking, is education by someone else, by an adult. So what we need is conversation between the parents and the children. We actually need to do the hard yards. We can't just offload this. We can't just abrogate responsibility and say, oh, well, yeah, just ban it. That makes life easier. No, let's do the hard work. Let's actually engage with this and critically approach it, get literate, understand how we can use it to benefit ourselves and to be really social. Social is about empathy, cooperation, instead of most social media, which is all the all point score and gamification.
Yeah. Dr. Stephen Conway is with you, Course Director for Games and Interactivity at Swinburne. We're talking about YouTube and whether or not it should be a part of the social media ban. Is it different to other forms of social media? So many texts on this. This one stood out to me. It said, ask any female teachers how they feel about teenage boys being influenced by YouTube. Michael's in Mount Dandenong. Morning, Michael.
Good morning.
What did you want to say?
Yeah, I think we're jumping the gun a little bit here, treating it just as social media, because it is really, for a lot of young people, it can be an educational tool. So having worked with both young kids and teenagers over the years, there is a dramatic shift away from that generation watching mainstream TV. So yes, they are using it like a television, but then different learners use it in different ways. I have seen some kids who just delve into history and just watch continual YouTube videos on history. I myself have used it for kind of how-to things, like how to repair things and those types of things. With our education system already in a disastrous state, I think, you know, to cut young minds off from easy access to information and learning could have a major detrimental effect on, you know, Australia's future to be. What I'd like to see the narrative change to is more to setting up, whether it's filtering or, you know, monitoring the time of what they're using it for. Like, are they sitting it there for 10 hours watching Mr. Beast, or are they sitting there actually learning and, you know, gaining knowledge from this?
And that's where you get the screen addiction from. Even though with the content you might be watching isn't harmful, there's still that addiction level to it. We could go on about this for hours, but just finally, Dr. Stephen Conway, I mean, we've got YouTube, we've got kids' YouTube. Is this a platform that is easier to monitor and, dare I say, the word police? Like, can we control this a little more than other forms of social media if we wanted to?
We can control it a little more because it is more limited than other social media in various ways. The friend-based interaction is less. There are no status updates, viral challenges and hashtags are much more limited. So we can curate and we can set parameters around it a little bit more, but it's still something that is based upon the user taking action first, and only after the fact can we moderate it, because these platforms are all about users uploading and giving content rather than providing content after it's been certified.
And some of the stuff kids watch. I watch my daughter watch these American women baking and trying food. And I'm like, how long can you watch this for? It turns out a long, long time. Just finally, Stephen, do you think it will be included? Will YouTube be included in the social media ban?
Sadly, I think it might be. I don't think the ban is at all a worthwhile pursuit. But yes, I think it might actually be included because it does have many of those features we associate with other platforms.
Good to get your insights as always. Dr. Stephen Conway, Course Director for Games and Interactivity at Swinburne University. We'll get back to your calls and your texts on this later in the program, as there are certainly plenty of them.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning, my name's Rochelle Hunt. Well, this next conversation is a serious one and it's a delicate one, but it's really important. And we're talking about suicide prevention. And there is an innovative new suicide prevention service that has just been unveiled at Monash Rural Health. And in particular, it works with and targets people who have actually attempted suicide or who have presented themselves to a health service with suicidal ideation. Dr. Anton Isaacs is from Monash Rural Health and has been the lead in this particular program. Anton, you've made your way down from beautiful Warragul in order to speak to us today. So thank you so much. This is a delicate and a tricky conversation to have, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't be having it. And when we talk about suicide prevention and the different ways to approach that, you have come up with a new strategy called HOPE. Now, that stands for Hospital Outreach Post-Suicidal Engagement. What makes it so different and unique?
Thanks for having me, Rochelle. First of all, this program was not developed by Monash Rural Health. It's developed by it's very, very easy to confuse it because we have Monash Health, mm-hmm. we have Monash University, and within Monash University, we have Monash Rural Health, and that's where I belong. And now, I'm a mental health services researcher. And I was doing some work for Monash Health Mental Health Services, and I met the manager of the Atherton Road Service, which is a HOPE service. And the HOPE service was part of the Victorian Suicide Prevention Framework. So they rolled out this program across Victoria, and they asked each of the mental health services to take this on and essentially deliver it. Now, Caroline LeBrun is the manager of the mm-hmm. Atherton Road Centre. So they asked her to design the service and roll it out. Now, she has worked for 25 years in this field. She's a social worker by background. So what she did was she knew that the way people with who present to emergency departments with suicidal attempt or suicidal ideation don't necessarily get the kind of care that they need. So she designed a service that was kind of different because she realized that the main thing that people require when they are in a crisis is empathetic support. Now, that's not something that is routinely given because we live in such a clinical environment. Most of the services are clinical, you know. But when somebody is in a crisis, what they need is empathetic support to help them to settle down, to overcome that crisis. Once that is done, then you can look at, do they have a mental health problem? Do they have other issues? So on and so forth. What has been happening is when people reach an emergency department with suicidal attempt, the focus is more clinical than non-clinical.
Than emotional.
Yeah.
And is that because it then builds, that empathy builds trust? I mean, would it have taken a lot for that person to present to an emergency department, to some kind of hospital setting, and thank goodness that they have, because it's an attempt to stay alive and to get help, and it would take a lot, and not everybody does that.
Yes.
So then that first interaction, I could imagine, would be vital.
Yes, absolutely. The thing is, people reach, I mean, there are multiple underlying reasons for somebody to start thinking about suicide, and we call it suicidal ideation. But they reach a point where they think they are on the edge of total overwhelming hopelessness. Nobody can help me. I'm much better off dead than alive. That's the point at which, and the reason they reach that stage is because they genuinely believe that there is no hope. So when somebody comes, presents to a service, what they're looking for is for it's somebody hope. To tell them it's okay.
There
you
is
know,
hope.
Yeah, there is hope. You don't have to take drastic steps.
How different is it to, we know in so many different types of service and, you know, especially with a social bent, any time of social work for people who are at risk, the peer-to-peer level of social work is often the best, the strongest, the most impactful, because you know they have walked a day, a month, a year, a lifetime in your shoes.
Absolutely.
So by going to people who have either attempted suicide or thought about it, and to use them to gauge and to direct your help and your research, how new is that? How revolutionary and how helpful is that?
It's not very new, but it hasn't yet taken off. I mean, they refer to as experts by experience, EBE, you know. If somebody comes to a service who is talking about suicide, who has attempted suicide, somebody who's an expert by experience knows exactly what to say, what language to use, what kind of tone, because they have walked in their shoes. Yeah. And these things you don't read in textbooks. Not yet, at least. I would think that in the course of time, these things will become commonplace. This is how you talk to somebody. This is how you know. But for now, we have people with lived experience who are sitting with them and say, okay, I'm here. You are safe. You don't have to worry. You know, everything will be fine. That's the first thing. And then immediately after that, they have to take care of some of the underlying issues that actually push them over the edge. And that's usually either financial or a place, a safe space, because many of them are in a situation that they don't feel safe. So we have a psychosocial worker at this at Clayton Hope. They have a psychosocial worker who will also sit with them and say, okay, what are the things that are really worrying you? Can we try and help you with that?
You're listening to Dr. Anton Isaacs from Monash Rural Health. I just want to give you some numbers if this has triggered anything in you and you feel like you do want to reach out for help. Lifeline, we always say save that number into your phone, 13 11 14, and Beyond Blue is 1-300-222-4636. We're talking about a new approach to suicide prevention. The strategy is called HOPE, and that stands for Hospital Outreach Post-Suicidal Engagement. Now, this has already been piloted, hasn't it, in multiple areas and hospitals and settings. How's it been working? What has the response been from individuals, from family members, from outreach workers? What have you been told?
Well, we see HOPE has been running across Victoria now, okay, for quite a few years. And it's been running in different avatars in different services because they just follow the guidelines are very broad, and every service can, you know, kind of design them according to their setting. But there are no really large scale evaluations of this service because it's run by public health services. You know, it's I have been trying to get funding to actually evaluate the Clayton Hope service, which is kind of unique, but it's not easy to get funding to do because it's a public health service. It's not, you know, it's not something different.
And so, is it because this strategy is also ongoing? So it's not just about somebody presenting, you help them on the spot and that's it. I know a lot of this program looks at, you know, what the risk is within the next 72 hours, you know, how to then construct a personal safety plan for the next, not just week, but for maybe for the next couple of months. So what I love about this is that it's looking at the root cause and not just how the person has presented at the time, and to stop that particular action, which we know could be detrimental and life-ending. How do you then work with the person to rebuild their life, to bring that hope back? That takes money and time and patience.
Yes. Hope services are designed, like for instance, the Clayton Hope Service is a 12-week program. So, but the most important part of that program is the initial, you know, making sure that they settle down. And then they go through this process of developing a safety plan, implementing. That plan is essentially giving them tools to be able to manage a situation if they encounter something like this in the future. What do they do? Whom do they go to first? What do they do, you know? And after 12 weeks, they are gently released into the community by establishing support systems in place so that when they leave, they are handed over to, usually it's the general practitioner or somebody else, who will take care of them, who will be the main person who will look after them during the, you know, the rest of their lives.
Who can access this particular program? Is this just in a public hospital setting? If general practitioners are listening, if social workers, even loved ones that are, have concerns about someone, how can this program be accessed?
So the Clayton Hope program originally started off with referrals from the emergency departments, but now they have expanded to general practitioners, to psychologists, because anybody can encounter somebody who comes up to them and says, you know, I've got suicidal ideation, and then what did they do there? So the Clayton Hope has now expanded to include referrals from general practitioners and others.
There's a text here that says, as a social worker, it is so great to hear how our profession is being talked about so positively. The Hope Service is so important because we know that the most critical, vulnerable period to help someone is in those first weeks after a suicide attempt, which this program is also addressing. That is just incredible. You must be getting really good response from those, whether they be social workers, from people in the area, that there are good guidelines now, that there is best practice to be able to follow, and something that is so delicate. It, as a community, we're only just starting to discuss openly.
You know, Rochelle, I am actually an outsider to this. I was doing some work for Monash Rural Health, and I stumbled upon, for Monash Health Mental Health Services, and I stumbled upon Caroline LeBrun, who's the champion of this whole program. And when she started telling me what she was doing, I said, Caroline, we need to write this up and publish it, because you're doing phenomenal work, because this is, lots of people are going to benefit from this. And that's how we published this, and lots of people seem to be very impressed with this whole thing.
Well, it's called HOPE. It stands for Hospital Outreach Post-Suicidal Engagement. Again, I want to give those numbers, Lifeline 13 11 14, Beyond Blue 1300 224636. Dr. Anton Isaacs from Monash Rural Health, thank you so much for making the trek down from beautiful Warragul. How is downtown Warragul at the moment?
It's beautiful.
It's always beautiful.
It's cold, yeah, but it's beautiful.
It has always been beautiful. Thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for the work that you do as well.
Thank you.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Still plenty of calls and texts coming in on whether or not YouTube should be included in the social media ban, and whether or not you see YouTube as social media, or just do you use it as a form of tally of television? This YouTube is a combination of social media and of unscripted TV. It already does everything from short form videos similar to TikTok. The comment section are quite interactive. It's no different from what happens on things like Reddit. The algorithm is equally useful and toxic, and it rewards some of the craziest content. But then others that says, Rish, as a senior, I use YouTube as television. I never really thought about it too much as its similarities with social media. As an adult, I can self-edit what I view. However, this conversation has made it very clear that this is a very different scenario for families, and maybe it does need to be treated like social media. That's from Phoebe, who's in Geelong. Well, last week we spoke about the role of a library and a role of a library beyond books. And around the world, many libraries are looking at how they can help people with all sorts of issues, because often the library is somewhere where people go if they feel unsafe at home, if they don't have warmth, if they don't have anywhere to be cool during summer, if you live in a really disruptive household and there's nowhere quiet or safe for you to study. And it's often the librarians that pick up on some of these other social welfare aspects and then maybe try and point them in the right direction. Now, across the globe, more and more libraries are now putting in check-in counters that have nothing to do with books. They are there for social welfare and for people to be pointed into the right direction. Now, this is something that's been happening in the Merribeck Council area. And just last night, the council made a decision on the role of their social worker that they have at their library. They were potentially going to have to strip that social worker right back to just 1 or 2 days a week, but there's been a fight to keep that social worker there in a full-time role, 5 days a week. The question is, how will it be funded? Sue Bolton is a Merribeck councillor. Sue, I mean, given the conversation we've just had about suicide prevention and this sort of work that's being done by social workers, libraries are a safe place. I think the idea of having a social worker embedded into a library makes perfect sense. What happened last night at council meeting?
Well, council last night voted to fund a full-time library social worker. The slight snag is they funded it for $10,000 less than a Band 6 social worker, which is quite an experienced social worker, because of the range of issues a social worker in a library would have to deal with. But it is a victory that the council has decided that they will have a full-time social worker, compared to what the council officers recommended, which was just stripping a social worker back to 2 days a week.
So the idea that any day of the week, if somebody comes and presents and wanting help, or is it more about the social worker being in the space and recognising that somebody may need assistance, may need to be connected with a particular department?
Well, it's a combination of both. And it's also support for the library staff as well, because libraries now, as you pointed out in the introduction, libraries now serve so many needs way beyond just borrowing books, because it is the only place you can go and sit for free. And there are a lot of people who use libraries who don't have computers at home. A lot of vulnerable people use libraries. And so there's a need for social workers in libraries to help people who are vulnerable, who might be looking for help, but also maybe helping people who might be traumatised for whatever reason, and who might be also, playing a bit of a disruptive role in the library, not through fault of their own, but through...
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? How do you strike that balance to ensure that everybody feels safe? You know, if you need someone that can handle really complex issues and be able to de-escalate situations, if somebody does have drug and alcohol concerns as well. Up until now, Sue Bolton is with you, Merribeck councillor. Last night, the councillors got together and fought to keep the social worker at the local library full-time, 5 days a week. Up until now, how has the role worked? What sort of things have they been doing? How successful has it been?
Well, there has been a trial period of 2 years with a library social worker full-time for those 2 years. Unfortunately, the council didn't continue the contract of the social worker at the end of the trial. But the trial has been a resounding success. The council even recognises that the trial has been a success. There are some improvements that need to be made. There are 5 libraries that the social worker needs to look after. There's probably enough work for 2 social workers.
Oh, right. So that one social worker moves around 5 different libraries, isn't just positioned at one library full time.
But there are probably 2 libraries where there is the most need, which are in the two busiest activity centres. And some of the libraries in other states, like in Adelaide, they're planning to employ or have just employed two social workers, one to provide support for staff and one to support to provide support for clients or users of the library.
Does it muddy the waters too much if it's starting to be seen as a place for social welfare and not as a library as such, given that you might have young teens on their own studying or reading, it's a place for story time, for families? As much as we want to help as many people and we want this to be a resource for those who need it the most, is there a risk of creating an environment where the two just don't work?
No, I don't believe that is the case, because people already coming to the library, a huge number of people are coming to use the library, and as well as the groups of people you mentioned, there are a lot of people who use the library because they have no computers at home, and also as government departments and private companies have pushed everyone online, it means a lot of people, including people who might have literacy issues, are forced to apply for all sorts of things online. They ask the library staff to assist them with complicated
immigration. Yeah, so it's something that shouldn't be the librarian's role. And what about, and so how do people react to it?
The social workers can help with all of that.
Yeah. How do just the general patrons, like people that are using the library for, you know, library purposes, what sort of reaction have you had from locals?
I think people are happy with a social worker being employed in the library, and I think a lot of people would prefer that approach rather than the council employing lots of security guards, which unfortunately that has been the direction the Mirrabooka Council has been going in. And it's a question of safety for library staff and patrons, and safety for vulnerable people, and assistance for vulnerable people who are using the library, as a lot of government services are being cut and people being given assistance to find solutions to the issues they're facing.
Good to get your thoughts on this, Sue, and we wish you the best of luck. The main thing we want is for, you know, everyone in their local community to feel safe and protected, and that goes for the individual who may need help. It goes for the librarian. It goes for the patrons. It goes for everyone. Sue Bolton, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Mirrabooka councillor there. They need to find a way to fund it, but they now have a full-time social worker at their local libraries. It's something you'd like to see at your local library as well. If you've just joined us at the beginning of the program, we've been talking about YouTube and whether or not you agree with the eSafety Commissioner, who would like to see YouTube now be included in the social media ban. Is YouTube a form of social media, or is it just a way to watch television, so to speak? Deborah's in Bentley. Morning, Deborah.
Good morning, Rochelle. I adore your program. You bring up the most amazing topics and always make us think.
Oh, aren't you gorgeous, Deborah? Thank you. What do you reckon, right? My daughter watches YouTube. She watches it like television. The show is deathly boring. I don't know why or how she watches it, but it's how she watches telly.
And I've got a finger in every pie. I have a vulnerable child who, like your last speaker was saying, he uses the library as a safe place, and he watches YouTube like TV. He's on the spectrum, ADHD, has dyslexia, he's a very visual learner, and we've fortunately been able to keep him away from all other forms of social media. Because he learns a lot. But
how do you make sure that the algorithm doesn't get nasty and that comments, like, have you just found a way to safeguard YouTube more than other social media platforms?
I got in really early, and fortunately, you know, he's going to be turning 18 later in the year, but emotionally he's more like a 15-year-old. And I got in really, really early knowing it was my responsibility to prepare my incredibly vulnerable, gentle child, I had to have all the orcs talks about porn, and, you know, trying to explain to him that once you've seen it, you can't unsee it. So parents have to be involved. Parents have to monitor, and you have to be communicating with your kids much, much younger than, you know, back in our day. You know, we're old fun.
I know, but remember, Deborah, when we would watch telly late at night, and even if your mum and dad thought you'd gone to bed, you'd get the phone sex ads or, you know, erectile dysfunction ads. They were all dodgy and wrong, but we watched them as kids.
And I think it comes back to talking about all of those, having those difficult, uncomfortable conversations with your kids and monitoring the content. And I say, you know, I used to say to him early days, you know, that language is appalling. Turn that off.
And things have changed.
He would be compliant. He would trust me.
Good on you, Deborah. Thank you. It's interesting, isn't it? I think there'll be a lot of parents scratching their heads around, you know, you can say no to Instagram, you can say no to Snapchat and all of that stuff, but then if you say, oh, we're going to also say no to YouTube as well, I'm not sure where we go from there. Some wonderful reactions to the Mary Beck Council, who have now got a full-time social worker at their local library. This is from Dom. It says, well done, Mary Beck Council, for acknowledging this role. I've witnessed staff at libraries also playing an important role in linking elderly people with aged care service help. Other councils should be looking at this. They're stripping back. It's great to hear that this role is happening. And another that says, my library in Ivanhoe also has a issue where a homeless lady uses the library, maybe washes in the ladies' bathroom. I feel there should be some other place and help that she could have as well, whether or not the library is the place to help her. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care, and we'll speak to you soon.